The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr., Gregory Stockel, Dan Novak, and Katie Weaver. Later, Ashley and I will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
The Cát Linh-Hà Đông City train line in Hanoi, Vietnam, entered service on November 21st. It is Vietnam's first metro train. People are saying good things about the train line, but others are questioning the project. The 13-kilometer-long line has 12 stations. It starts at Cát Linh Railway Station in north-central Hanoi and ends in the southwestern area of Hà Đông. The train can travel at up to 80 kilometers an hour. The trip along the whole line takes about 24 minutes. It is designed to be able to carry 1 million passengers a day when finished. The line is expected to ease traffic and reduce private vehicle use in Hanoi. Citizens in Vietnam's capital said the quality of the service is good. They are hopeful about the metro line. A Hanoi office worker who asked that her name not be used noted that she cannot use the new line to get to work. But she said she hopes it will help reduce traffic, shorten travel times, and reduce transportation pressures. Since I care about the environment, people's use of public transport will make a significant contribution to reducing dust and noise pollution, she told VOA. During 2 weeks of free trial service, at its opening, crowds gathered to ride. But Vietnamese media last month reported a lack of passengers. Reports from the first days of ticket sales suggest that the number of passengers was low, at about 12,000 a day. That is equal to only 8% of capacity. This should worry the Hanoi city government, which oversees the project. Building the line has been delayed by many years and has cost more money than officials planned. In 2008, the project had a total starting budget of $552.8 million. By 2017, the amount had increased to about $868 million. Leaders of the transport industry have so many times promised to put it into operation, but then the promises are broken, causing people to be angry and skeptical, said Nguyen Van Kain, a retired worker in Hà Đông. Du Ang works in public relations at a company that deals in property. She told VOA that the people of Hanoi used to have high expectations for the Metro line. But after so many missed deadlines, the people were unsure. It was not until the Metro line operated that I dared to believe that it had finally happened, she said. Observers say Vietnam lacks the experience to carry out such projects. It is just the second city railway in Vietnam after the Nguyen Hanoi line, which is still being built. South China Sea disputes between Vietnam and China add to the difficulties. China is a major provider of money for the project. But the project faced delays after China placed an oil exploration structure in nearby waters claimed by Vietnam. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Martin Janoshek and Stu Aaron make whiskey in a small lab in California's Silicon Valley. Whiskey is a sort of alcoholic drink that is made from fermented grains. Usually, whiskey is aged in barrels made from the wood of an oak tree. But in this lab, there are no barrels. Instead, they are using scientific equipment like syringes, beakers, and vials. They are doing this to find a more environmentally friendly way to make whiskey. This modern consumer, they tend to care about causes like climate change, said Aaron, co-founder and chief commercial officer of Menlo Park-based Bespoken Spirits. The alcoholic drink spends 3 to 5 days in a small metal barrel. The company's technology speeds up oxidation, or a process where oxygen is introduced to a mixture. This changes the taste of the whiskey. A small piece of wood from an oak tree, no larger than the size of a small finger, is introduced in this process. The whiskey takes on the color, smell, and taste of the wood while it spends the time in the metal barrel. They lightly burn the oak wood in the lab before cutting it into small pieces known as microstaves. Microstaves are about 1/25,000th the size of a traditional barrel. Janoshek is a material scientist and company co-founder. He said this permits them to use 97% less wood. By getting rid of the barrels completely, they can avoid cutting down trees as well as the cost of storing barrels for years in climate-controlled conditions. Because of the short amount of time their whiskey ages, Bespoken does not lose liquid to evaporation. This lost liquid is known as the angel's share. Aaron said this permits them to use 20% less water. The Bespoken team runs samples in a gas chromatograph when making the whiskey. This process splits the gas into its basic parts, permitting them to know its chemical identity. Knowing its chemical identity permits them to create unique ways the drink can be used and to follow tastes like vanilla. I'm Gregory Stockel.
shootings like the one that occurred on November 30th at Oxford High School in Michigan are not uncommon in the United States. The Oxford shooter killed 4 students and wounded 7 others. Education Week tracks school shootings. It has found 31 shootings this year that had at least one death. A Washington Post investigation found that more than 278,000 students have experienced gun violence at schools since the Columbine High School shooting in April 1999. School officials, lawmakers, and others are trying different ways to prevent school shootings or reduce the number of deaths. Many schools practice active shooter drills, which are meant to prepare students and staff for a real event. Other schools place police officers in and around their buildings. In Oxford, the parents of the shooter are being charged with a crime in connection with the killings. Karen McDonald is the Oxford County lead prosecutor. She argues that James and Jennifer Crumbly, parents of the shooter Ethan Crumbly, could have prevented the attack. "We should all be looking at the events that led up to that horrific event," McDonald said on American television. "And as a community, as a school, as a nation, talk about what we could have done different so that didn't happen."
On November 30th, a teacher found a note written by Ethan with a drawing of a handgun, and the message, "The thoughts won't stop. Help me." After a meeting with Crumbly and his parents, school officials thought he was not a risk to other students and could return to class. The parents also refused a request to take him home for the day. Later that day, Crumbly opened fire on fellow students with a gun his father had given him 4 days earlier as a gift. School officials in Oxford are also being investigated to see if their actions could have stopped the shooter. 2 legal actions were brought against the Michigan School District Thursday for permitting the shooter to stay in school after he showed signs of very troubling behavior. Gun control advocates hope the charges against the Crumbly parents will show ways to deal with other school shootings. Shannon Watts is the founder of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, an organization that supports gun control measures. She wrote in the Washington Post that children and students should not be able to access guns. She believes the charges against the Crumleys will force all gun-owning parents to consider additional safety measures. Oxford High School had many safety measures in place. Watts wrote, "Yet all of these measures weren't enough to stop a school shooting because the student still had access to a gun at home." The organization Every Town for Gun Safety says 5.4 million children in the U.S. live in a home with a gun.
Active shooter drills are common in American schools. During the drills, students practice how to react if a shooter enters the school. Students are taught to lock the doors to the classroom, turn off the lights, sit on the ground, and be quiet. Oxford County Sheriff Michael Bouchard said the drills saved lives at Oxford High. A Washington Post report found that 4 million students went through active shooter drills in 2018. But critics say these drills can traumatize children. David Reedman is with the National Center for Homeland Defense and Security. He studies school shootings. He told the Washington Post that the drills did save lives at Oxford, but he believes very realistic shooter drills are not needed. Research has found that more than half of gun owners do not lock up their guns. Some schools have started sending letters to parents to tell them how to safely keep a gun. One school system in Los Angeles requires parents to sign a notice about gun safety. The Clark County school system in Nevada does something similar. Maddie Amati is a student in Vermont who led an effort to get her school to send a letter home to parents about safely storing guns. She told Education Week that it is an issue of safety, not politics. "I'm not telling anyone to stop hunting, and I'm not telling anyone to give away their gun. I'm telling them to securely store them so we can prevent tragedies like what happened in Oxford," she said. I'm Dan Novak.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
And now we present The Making of a Nation. The American nation began to expand west during the middle 1800s. People settled in the great open areas of the Dakotas, Utah, Wyoming, and California. The movement forced the nation to deal with great tribes of Native American Indians. The Indians had lived in the Western territories for hundreds of years. Settlers and cattle ranchers pushed the Indians out of their homelands. The result was a series of wars between the tribes and the federal government.
At first, the United States government had just one policy to deal with the Indians. It was brutal. Whenever settlers wanted Indian land, the tribes were pushed farther west. If the Indians protested or tried to defend their land, they were destroyed with crushing force. By the middle 1800s, almost all the eastern Indians had been moved west of the Mississippi River. They were given land in Indian Territory in what is now the state of Oklahoma. The government described these Indians as civilized. This meant they were too weak to cause more trouble. Many agreed to follow the ways of the United States government.
The Indians of the Western grasslands were different. They refused to give up their way of life. These Plains Indians were always on the move because they hunted buffalo, the American bison. They followed great groups of the animals across the grassy plains. At that time, there were millions of these animals in the American West. The Indians of the plains depended on the buffalo for almost everything they needed. Many of them were fierce fighters. The Plains Indians did not want settlers crossing their hunting lands. They often tried to destroy the wagon trains carrying settlers to California and Oregon.
The United States Army was given the job of keeping peace. Soldiers were sent to build roads and forts in the Western Plains. They tried to protect the wagon trains from Indian attacks. They tried to keep settlers from invading Indian lands. There were many fights between the soldiers and the Plains Indians. The soldiers had more powerful weapons. They usually won.
Some Plains Indians tried to live peacefully with the settlers. One such group was part of the Sioux tribe, called Santee Sioux. It was the largest and most powerful group in the West. The Santee Sioux lived along the northeastern edge of the Great Plains in what is now the state of Minnesota. They signed treaties with the government, giving up 90% of their land. The Santee agreed to live in a small area. In exchange, the United States agreed to make yearly payments to the tribe. This made it possible for the Indians to buy food and other things from traders.
Trouble started, however, in the summer of 1862. The government was late giving the Indians their yearly payment. As a result, the Indians lacked the money to buy food. Traders refused to give the Indians credit to buy food. One trader said, "If they are hungry, let them eat grass." The Indians were hungry. Soon, their hunger turned to anger. Finally, the local Indian chief called his men together. He gave the orders for war. Early the next morning, the tribe attacked the trading stores. Many of the traders were killed, including the man who had insulted the Indians. He was found with his mouth filled with grass. The governor of Minnesota sent a force of state soldiers to stop the Indian revolt. The soldiers had artillery. They killed several hundred Indians in battle. They hanged several others. Soon, the revolt was over.
Trouble came next to parts of Colorado and Wyoming. This is where the Sioux Indians and the Cheyenne Indians lived. The chief of the Lakota Sioux tribe was named Red Cloud. The Indians fought bitterly to keep settlers out of their hunting grounds. After 2 years of fighting, with many deaths on both sides, the government decided the struggle was too costly. It asked for peace. The Sioux and the Cheyenne agreed. They were given a large area of land north of Wyoming in the Dakota Territory. They also were given the right to use their old hunting lands farther north. The government agreed to close a road used by settlers to cross the hunting grounds. And all soldiers were withdrawn from Sioux country.
The war ended, and peace came to the Sioux and the Cheyenne. With peace came a new United States policy towards Indians of the West. The government decided to put aside an area of land for each tribe. The land was called a reservation. Each tribe would live on its own reservation. Most of the reservations were in Indian Territory in what is now the state of Oklahoma. Other reservations were in Dakota, near the land of the Sioux.
The government believed it would cost less money and fewer lives to keep Indians on reservations. The Indians would be away from possible trouble with settlers. Instead of moving freely over the plains to hunt buffalo, the Indians would live in one place. They would receive food and money from the government. Officials came from Washington to explain this new policy to the Indians. A big meeting was held. Chiefs representing many tribes attended. The chiefs spoke, one after another, to the government officials.
All of the chiefs said they, too, wished to live in peace with the United States government. But many questioned the decision to move to reservations. One who did so was Chief Ten Bears of the Comanche tribe. He said, "There are things which you have said to me that I do not like. You said you wanted to put us on a reservation. You said you would build houses for us. I do not want your houses. I was born on the plains where the wind blows free and there is nothing to break the light of the sun. I was born where everything breathed a free breath. I want to die there, not within walls."
So the government and the Indians reached a compromise. The tribes were given reservations in Indian territory, but they were also given permission to hunt buffalo in a wide area south of the reservations. The Indians agreed to give up all their old lands. They agreed to live in peace on the reservations. In exchange, the United States promised to give the Indians all the food, clothing, and other things they needed. It also promised to give them schools and medical care.
The Indians were not happy with this agreement. They did not want to give up their old ways of living. However, they saw they had no choice. The government was too strong. They waited weeks, then months, for help to move to the new reservations. They could not understand the delay in carrying out the agreement. The delay was in Washington, D.C. Congress could not agree on how much money to spend on the Indians. So the lawmakers refused to approve the agreement. They left the situation unsettled. Again, Indians were forced to watch angrily as settlers began moving on to lands they had agreed to give up. As the settlers moved in, the buffalo and other animals left. The Indians had difficulty finding food.
Soldiers shared their food with the Indians. It was not enough. Western officials sent urgent messages to Washington asking for supplies for the Indians. No supplies could be sent until Congress approved the money to buy them. As before, some of the Indians became angry and refused to wait any longer. Their anger led to new fighting. In the end, it was a fight that failed to win back their land.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.